Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster, sitting in studio with Stefan Hostetter.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastically.
Excellent.
We have, I'm starting off, basically, we're gonna like roll down a hill today because we're going to start off kind of slow. And the end of the show is going to be full of, we're going to pull out of retirement the Feisty Wheaties thing.
Excellent.
Because I have some, this week's edition of Tough Love for Trudeau.
This week's edition of some Tough Love.
I also have a challenge. I'm going to be doing that at the end of the show. I have a gauntlet that will be thrown down today. But as you can tell from my voice, we're going to start off. We're gonna get there.
Yeah.
In the middle of the program, we're gonna basically spend the entire middle of the show talking about the DAPL, Standing Rock Sioux protest against the North Dakota pipeline that is continuing to evolve. We have over 260 people now total who have been arrested over the whole time period, with about half of those taking place in the last few days. I'm actually a little bit unclear on some of the timing here, but we'll get through the details and we'll sort that out in the middle of the program. End of the show is going to be largely about national news. We have a few stories about Trudeau, etc. as well. But for now, Stefan will be our guide. Take it away, Stefan.
Thank you. So a couple weeks ago, I gave a preview of a ongoing segment I wanted to talk about, which is sort of this idea that we need to plan to win. That environmentalists need to start building up some capacity within ourselves and within our communities to allow for the effects to prepare for the effects of climate change and climate change regulation and regulations on emissions and to really build up the capacity for us to actually live a low carbon future, because the efforts that we're currently putting forth are not enough. Since then, I haven't talked about it at all. But it's back. This is part one of an unknown part series, but it begins with a sort of a headline of news that came out just today or yesterday, and I'll eventually get there. So bear with me half a second, because this is a fascinating piece of news. So an article in the Wall Street Journal. Whenever I get to talk about the Wall Street Journal, I'm always excited because it means there's some business news that suddenly becomes important to us. And no one can ever claim the Wall Street Journal is biased, because if they're biased, they're biased in the other direction. So it's great.
Yeah, so they're like the lowest common denominators. Like, if they're there, then you really have to be thick to be past them.
Exactly,
they're the litmus test for plausible deniability, not on the facts, but on like that's about as ignorant as you could be.
Yeah, like right beside the Wall Street Journal article was a hit piece on Hillary Clinton. So like on this article, and there's a hit piece on Hillary Clinton.
Fair and balanced.
Exactly. So this article is about Exxon, which posted a 38% decline in quarterly profit.
Sorry, can you just say that number?
Exxon reported a 38% decline in quarterly profit.
That sounds better every time I hear it.
Yeah, which now still is $2.7 billion of earnings. So this is not like this is only profit. It's not losing money, just making less money, basically. Right. But that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is that it's also currently under state and federal investigation for how it accounts for the value of its oil and gas wells. And on Friday, Exxon itself stated that may need to recognize 4.6 billion barrels of its reserves as no longer profitable to produce. And so the monumental piece of this is can't be understated, I think, in my mind, because this is, to my knowledge, one of the first times and on such a scale that an oil company is admitting that it has stranded assets. You know, we've said the word stranded assets so many times on the show, I can't even count them. But the idea that Exxon is now admitting that 4.6 billion barrels that it has will not come to market.
is... Which, considering what we know about Exxon and the oil industry and just large corporations in general, almost certainly larger than that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure they're trying to hedge their bets right now. But the idea that they have to then admit that they will not actually be using this feeds this larger narrative, which I'll get to in half a second. But the last thing, what's interesting about this 4.6 barrels, especially for us as Canadians, is that most of this is all from the oil sands in Alberta. So most of this is them saying that we cannot make this, the low price of oil likely means that it will never be profitable for us to use this oil. So why does this matter? What matters, because as I said earlier, it feeds into this concept of stranded assets. It feeds into this larger piece of whether or not and how we are going to be able to pay, or how we understand the valuation of oil companies. The sooner that the oil companies start admitting that parts of their assets are stranded, which basically means that they will never come to market, yet are included currently in the value of the company. So how it works right now is that there's, this 4.6 billion barrels are included as value for Exxon. Mm-hmm. And them admitting this basically removes that value, or that understanding of that value. And if this becomes a trend, which is what generally environmentalists have been arguing will have to happen if we're going to deal with climate change, and will happen if we are going to hit the Paris Agreement, is that approximately 80% of known oil reserves will become stranded assets. That this market shock is what we need to be preparing for, and is what will be the driver in part to a low carbon economy, or it will be understood as that's a piece of it that we have to accept. And so what this ties into, which is it's a growing trend of larger institutions accepting this reality. Even just last month, BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, which has almost $5 trillion of assets, issued a report recommending that investors include climate risks in their decisions. Now, this could easily just be things like, if you don't invest in things near the edges of water that could rise and ruin it, rather than don't expect that the bottom will fall out of the price of carbon. But it's still a very, very important recommendation. Their quote actually is, "Investors can no longer ignore climate change. Some may question the science behind it, but all are faced with a swelling tide of climate-related regulations and technological disruption." It's part of a 16-page report that they mentioned on this. And there's this fascinating piece that the concern, interestingly, here is that you're looking at a bunch of people. Most people don't manage their own money. Very, very few people actually manage their own money. And so almost everybody is invested in some way in fossil fuels. And so this whole planning to win piece not only has to respect the fact that of planning for a low carbon economy, it also in some way has to include this understanding that the oil bubble, the carbon bubble, the bubble that is currently exists of this all these assets that the oil companies will eventually not be able to use, if that bursts, the amount of wealth, quote-unquote wealth, that will be lost at one moment would dwarf the housing crisis.
It's a good thing our entire economy is not chained to this so-called oil industry, Steph. otherwise, the Canadian economy might be devastated. Unlike how we dodged the housing crisis, we could be the U.S. in a future thing. But thank goodness we're not.
Yes, or Iceland, as far as the people who really went down. And what's interesting here is that what this means is that it's not only this whole planning to win thing not only has to include the idea of actually expecting low carbon futures. It also has to plan for what happens if this rate of technology change happens quickly enough to burst this bubble before we're really actually ready for it. Because there's once as the whole HFC conversation we had last week and the week before proved, once there is an obvious economic benefit for the right countries and business interests to get off carbon, it will happen very, very quickly. The same thing, as soon as the United States company came up with HFCs, how quickly did we have an actual ban on CFCs? And here, looking at things like the dramatically decreasing price of solar and battery prices for transportation, because transportation really is right now the crux of what's keeping up the fact that oil is king, right? Is that the battery prices have declined by 65% since 2010, 35% of that in 2015 alone, and market research expects another 35% decline in 2016. And of course, this is from Bloomberg. This is from Bloomberg New Energy Finance. This is not, again, it's not some liberal think tank. This is Bloomberg. And so the moment that we see this, the moment that we suddenly get serious about taking on carbon, that carbon bubble bursts immediately. And then suddenly the question becomes, okay, what are we going to do to survive that? How are we going to get through the hardships this really tough transition period from one part of our economy to the next? There's even the housing crisis proved that even a disruption really, really hurts everyone. Not just, it's not just the housing market that went down. It was that they went down and took a whole swath of the economy with them. And the idea that the carbon economy is so much bigger and so much wider reaching. And so all of this is to say, and get to this point of what can we do? What can we as environmentalists do? What do we have? What should we be focusing on to actually take this seriously? Because it's not just a matter of protecting the planet from climate change. It's a matter of protecting our most vulnerable citizens from the impacts of this carbon bubble, which no one seems to be willing to deflate. So eventually, let us pop. One of my favorite quotes is that when asked about how something came on, someone said slowly and then all at once. And that's you can kind of feel that. Right now we're in the slowly, and then they're going to see something that's going to happen all at once. And so what can we do? And I think the first part that I kept coming back to, I kept working through my brain on this. I have 50 different sheets of paper that I've sort of drawn out and mapped out these different ways of what planning to win would really look like.
I've seen it. Stefan doodles a lot.
Yeah, I do. And one big piece I kept coming back to was this idea of community resilience. Because each part of the everything sort of kept in some ways coming back to this point of community resilience, and what that means is sort of the power that communities can have to protect and keep afloat their own. I had a whole conversation recently, yesterday with someone about the Mennonite community, mm-hmm. and about how they had gone, they had seen hundreds and thousands, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids come through their schools, and never once had there been any sort of note of, never once had they heard of a single Mennonite committing suicide because of the community that they so strongly hold. Mm-hmm. And what this leads to is this idea of when you are really, really committed to your community and community resilience, the people, you can survive these kind of shocks. Whether or not it's climate related or economy related, you are positioned well enough to protect yourself from these kind of shocks. And so I kept coming back to what are these things that lead to community resilience? Examples of things like the budding library movement, which I've started calling it the library movement instead of the sharing economy, because everyone has decided the sharing economy includes Uber, and that makes no sense to me. So I'm having to come up with a new term to differentiate it from these two things. So things like our friends at the Toronto Tool Library or Seed Libraries, or even things like Bunn's Trading Zone, which is this massive trading network within Toronto, are all examples of how you can build in community resilience, because you don't need $300 to live well with these sort of tech tools and communities at your disposal. And even further, you sort of look at what people are doing with urban farms and local food. Again, if a massive price shock happens and food costs from transportation dramatically increase, do you know what keeps costing the same money? The thing you're growing in your own yard or in a community plot down the street or anywhere like that. These are the things that sort of provide. And they do a dual purpose of not only providing the tools and the ways to withstand these shocks. In if I need a tool, I don't need to go buy one. I can go to the library. If I need some carrots, I can go to my local plot. It also creates a community around them where people look out for each other. If you come into a space and where I know that I may not be the kind of person who, say, would just randomly give to United Way or something like that. But if I see someone who's right in front of me who is a part of my own personal community, I may be way more likely to actually help that person because you've already built this. And it's that proof that sort of community building and community within smaller ties is what really actually helps people. you know, and giving them dignity and keeping people involved in the whole process, rather than sort of the idea of like, oh, there's charity to solve this thing. I had the benefit of listening to, of hearing one of the of a really big food policy guy yesterday at a TEDx talk, and his big thing was that charity and food and giving food away is not, it will not solve the hunger crisis. I can't just give you a monthly meal every day and solve your hunger crisis, because you will be hungry tomorrow if I'm only giving food. You have to take a step back. You have to create that community and give the social programs and provide, you know, a basic income, and that's what will solve hunger. And I think it's that understanding that we can't. We've shifted so much right now in consumer culture that everyone is a consumer. Even the people who don't have money have to now consume from food banks or consume from other things. Whereas what we need, what we were seeing in these different, you know, in libraries, in local food movements, even in sort of the idea of co-working and couch surfing and all these sort of these communities that are sort of coming up, is this shift towards back away from consumers to people. And that's what makes communities resilient, is the fact that, you know, the, you know, Loblaws doesn't care if I can't afford to buy from them. That like the consumer you know, producer relationship implies nothing beyond a monetary transaction. And I think the moving away or pulling back from that consumer nature to this more community-based approach is the first step to not only reducing emissions generally, because these are what these often end up being. These communities allow us to be more efficient on how we use our tools, more efficient on how we use our, you know, our gasoline, because we're not actually going, you know, transporting all our things from, you know, Florida, and more efficient on how we actually use our space to this much bigger, deeper use of you know, oh, you need a tool, or you need some sugar or anything like that, you're in my community. And it's this community resilience piece that I think is incredibly important and perhaps the first fundamental layer of this ongoing movement to do that.
Sorry, I just we've got about a minute left, and I've been thinking about something I wanted to make a quick relation to that very much on that point, which is you were talking about the idea of like community and resilience, and it made me think, we're not going to get into it today, but there's been a lot of news about the American election, and also the TPP and CETA as well recently, and I just wanted to use, because I think it plays perfectly off what you were just saying about this idea that, like, you know, when we're talking about people that argue for, you know, not in a like muhahaha, I'm pulling the wool over people's eyes and I'm really doing this for my own gain. I think there are some of those people. But most of the people, most of the Clintons in the world and folks like that, and Trudeau, absolutely same pile, where they think, no, like, you know, those stupid kids or those stupid activists don't understand. They don't see the big picture. When we, you know, create efficiency, this is the best thing because that's how prices get down and you don't understand economics. But I've attacked that from 37 different angles before. I'm going to take a different tact, playing off what you were just saying, though, which is that there's this idea that I heard, and Stefan, of course, has a philosophy background, so I think he'll like this, of this idea that, you know, mercy and justice are two values that as a society we value. We think that mercy and justice are good traits, good values. But they are, in fact, in conflict. Perfect justice and perfect mercy cannot exist simultaneously, because perfect mercy is a suspension of justice. That's the definition of mercy, right? And so resiliency and efficiency have the same relationship. You can have both. They're both good qualities. We want to have as much of both as we can, but there is a limit, right? The sweet spot is in the middle, not at the extreme. And mindsets of these like uber capitalists, these neoliberals, all these like free trade agreements, these are all maximize efficiency, maximize efficiency, maximize efficiency. But the more you maximize efficiency, the more you decrease adaptability. And so, like, let's take a really quick look at an ecosystem. It's a very complex place, but it's fairly resilient because you can knock out a few pieces here and there. Something can go extinct. Poison can come in and kill a few species. And as long as otherwise the ecosystem is healthy, aka adaptable, has some adaptability, some flexibility in that system, it will adapt. no problem. But if a capitalist, if Hillary Clinton or Justin Trudeau or any of these other folks come on in, they'd say, oh, look at this mess. This is not efficient at all. Okay, let's wipe out all the things. What's the predator that we want? We want to eat bear meat or whatever. What's a big predator? We want to consume it or we want to use it for something. Great. Okay, what do bears eat? All right, knock out everything but what the bear eats and what that thing eats. So you create a single chain, right? This type of moss feeds this type of chipmunk. Oh, great. That's incredibly efficient. You'd increase production of bears by 9,000,000%. But guess what happens? Now you have a thing where a single gust of wind and the whole thing comes crashing down. And that's what sneeringly down their you know, the ends of their noses, they don't understand, because they think that efficiency is actually the ultimate goal, not realizing that, sure, some efficiency is very important. But if you don't have adaptability, you're dooming yourself. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, you very adequately described what we're currently doing with the agricultural system. We are prioritizing monocultures to get as much as possible at the expense of resilient crops. That's literally what we're doing right now.
And when you make that as you know, when you do something like a food supply, you're basically maximizing fragility. I don't want to hear about it, this increasing efficiency. You're maximizing fragility when you do that. And I think that is the ethos of all neoliberal BS. Mm-hmm. Is maximize fragility. Is that's all I want to see people say from now on. We better get to our music break, though, unfortunately. Neil, who's back with us again this week, do you want to let us know what we're going to listen to?
A lie nation. Alienation.
And we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I also want to just acknowledge we've had occasional phone calls asking us to slow down. Stefan, you remind me and I'll remind you.
Yeah, exactly. One of us has to remember.
Yeah. Well, we do our best, but Stefan and I are both naturally very fast speakers, and I get pretty worked up. I don't know, but Stefan seems to keep his cool, but I get pretty worked up during the show. So
my fear is always if I don't speak quickly enough, I'll forget what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And so I just have to get it all out there or I'm just going to lose it.
So maybe we can create a fund to release a like slowed down version of the podcast.
Listen to everything at 1.5 speed.
Everything will sound very calm. All right. Aside from that, we'll do our best and noted and sorry, but we're just kind of like this. So moving on. So Stefan, you're going to give me a really quick, just a very, very overview, 1 second recap of actually what is going on with the DAPL Dakota Access Pipeline protest. A very busy news week for that this week, and then we're going to relate that to a bunch of other news as well. But if you just give us the timeline real quick.
Yeah, for sure. So the week started off with on Monday. More than 127 specifically, people were arrested over the weekend and then also on Monday. And they were facing a range of charges, including reckless endangerment, criminal trespass, engaging in a riot, and resisting arrest, and assault on a police officer. Now, of course, all of that should be taken with a relative grain of salt, given the fact that, or not relative, a very large grain of salt, given the fact that these are peaceful protesters who are being approached by actual tanks.
Yeah.
Like actual tanks. And men in riot gear. It's like if you had to say it's a riot if you show up in riot gear. So there's a bunch of people sitting peacefully, you show up in riot gear. Now it's a riot, because why else would there be riot cops? I don't understand.
Well, and just because you mentioned the picture really quickly, I mean, if you look at some of the pictures, you'll notice one really key difference, which is even here, you know, in Toronto, where we're broadcasting from right now, we remember very often, and it happens all over the world, but for us, here in comfortable North America, it doesn't happen that often. So our go-to example for us here in Toronto is, of course, the G20. And one of the signal signs you remember from the G20, among many other things, is a sea of shields, right? Yeah. Riot shields. It's very defensive. That's where how they do things like kettling. This is not what you see when you look at the police photos, law enforcement lined up outside the DAPL protests. What you see are officers all carrying big sticks. This is 100% about intimidation, 0% about protecting the public interest. The police.
Well, there are no public around. Like, what are you, like? It's not like these people are doing it. They're staying in a space and they're occupying it as a part of a peaceful protest. The idea that you can show up and then incite violence and then get arrest people for the violence that you've incited is ludicrous.
Yeah. If anyone saw the photos here and you and didn't know anything about what officers look like, and you just read the story and just for some reason didn't know what a police officer's uniform looked like, you would assume that the police officers are the one causing the riot. There's no defensive posture. They're sitting there, you know, smoking, playing on their cell phones. But they're all holding big sticks. And by big sticks, I don't mean billy clubs. I mean baton, like not, and not like police issue batons. They're holding big wooden sticks.
Yeah.
This is 100% about intimidation. It's absolutely terrifying. Let me let you finish the timeline.
So yesterday, a whole bunch of more there's another clash, I guess you can say. I don't know. I should really look up exactly how to talk about these sort of things, because it's always wording can be very, very important. But more than 200 police showed up yesterday in riot gear and deployed pepper spray and armored vehicles to push protesters off the land belonging to the pipeline company. So here's the thing. This is when you go back to sort of resisting arrest or inciting a riot. You're pushing these people off land they're peacefully occupying. To expect them not to resist your encroachment is ludicrous.
Yeah.
And as 16 more people were arrested yesterday, and then the police will be on the scene, quote unquote, as long as it takes.
Well, guess what? So are the protesters.
Yeah, and so the protesters reported the police's use of stun guns, rubber bullets, and beanbag rounds, and of course the police chief says that they were not deployed as far as I know, which is mildly useless.
Yeah. There's meanwhile keeping a media blackout. So one of the other interesting things, they initiated a no-fly zone. Some of the people that were there to observe, they're being labeled in basically depending on what news source you go from, they're labeled as journalists in the independent media, and they're labeled as activists and rioters in the mainstream media. Same people. Journalists,
yeah,
largely using some obviously unarmed drones, which was then shot down by a police officer, literally shot down with I'm assuming a handgun.
Yeah,
and they've implicated a media blackouts, reports of cell phone signals being disrupted, and theorized that they were being calls that did go through were being recorded. Cell phone signals appear to have been suppressed. There's also news coming out now about the guards we reported on from a few weeks ago, not officers, but security guards for the North Dakota Pipeline Company, who moved in, who deployed dogs to intimidate and attack protesters as well, could be forcing criminal charges, according to an investigation, due to the fact that they did not, in North Dakota, they do not have licensing and could face criminal charges for deploying dogs to essentially attack people. So, I mean, yeah. once you're using a tactic that is not authorized, you're essentially just... The fact that you're security guard for the pipeline company is irrelevant. You just showed up as a big gang of people to sick dogs on people you didn't like. You know, for however else you want to contextualize it, that remains pretty much immutable.
And I'm going to jump in I'm gonna take us off track for half a second just to relate to another thing that's happened yesterday, or actually earlier today maybe, and just this deeper understanding and this deeper hypocrisy, I think, of how the state. As a uniform term for the United States government, and also how many media places are reporting on this kind of thing, we didn't really report on too much because it wasn't exactly a news story for us, but the Oregon standoff that happened earlier this year, which was armed people, armed militia men.
Let's be very clear, armed white people.
Yes, yes. Armed white men who are decided that I believe it all stems from the fact that one rancher didn't want to pay a head tax on his cattle, decided to occupy a relatively remote Oregon state public land, like public land, basically.
Mm-hmm. It was government offices. I forget exactly what it was, but it was some sort of government office.
I think no one was actually in it. I think it was it was so remote that no one actually used it, but they occupied it as a way to make a point. And these were armed men.
Who made threats of violence against police officers. Don't have the direct quote, but it's paraphrased quote. I'm not reading too much into it. The wording might be different, but the content is the same, saying that if the police officers tried to push into the building, that they would fire on them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was a 41-day standoff that of them sort of keeping in their space. And this was, it was reported in this weird way of It was reported in the sort of like, this is an odd thing that's happening. We don't know what's going on. But at one point, you know, the CNN was actually just playing CNN was giving them a platform to sort of speak freely about what, you know, their perceived injustices were facing.
Let's also add that the media was freely allowed to move in and out, and that these people were making almost daily interviews.
Oh, yeah.
Including receiving mail.
Yeah.
Mail was being delivered to this building. Also, warm massages by the police chief. No, I may have added that last one.
So yeah, so like again, it was still a tense situation. So they dealt with, but what matters here is that yesterday they were let go. The people who did this, the jury found them not guilty.
To be clear, I believe five of them were like, I don't know five, if everybody
yeah, sorry, not everyone
off.
Not everyone yeah right. some of them just had pleaded guilty to conspiracy,
right?
And so 26 people have been charged, but this was like a certain subset, including like the all what's his Amon Bundy, which is like the sort of the head, one of the heads of this organization, and this was a jury basically decided that this was allowed. That you can, as an armed militia group, take over a government building and stay there 41 days, and then contrast that with anything that happens to any racialized person in America. For a long time this kept being shown as like an example of like how whiteness can like the watch whiteness work line of like what you can get away with, basically. But a bigger part of it is it's a much stronger allegory to DAPL. Which are here people who are standing up for something they believe in, and they're occupying land, and now 226 of them have been arrested. They've been pepper sprayed. They've been shot with bullets. And something tells me they're not going to get the same kind of jury that these guys did. And you know, it's.
So there's one last sort of angle to this that I think is really important. I want to get to in our last couple minutes, which is sort of another angle. This is some reporting done by DSmog blog, and this actually came out just before the most recent round of arrests. So it's a piece looking into, and of course, this as well as all of our news stories every week are posted on the website at greenmajority.ca. So you can go, and I encourage you to read these on your own, have a flip through them on your own. Don't take my word for it. I mean, you can, but you shouldn't. So what I was talking about was something called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which authorizes states to enter into agreements to share resources and personnel during a state of emergency. This law was put into place, I believe, 2014? No, sorry, much older. Anyway, forget the date. The date doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The point is that this was brought into as a disaster relief and has been used during several hurricanes, most recently including Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Matthew. This is a disaster relief piece of legislation. The idea is essentially is that if one of the states in the U.S. Declares a state an emergency because of a disaster of some type, including largely having to do with natural disasters, but there is language in there to manage things, quote, like community disorders, insurgency, and enemy attack, to allow states to essentially send police officers out of state and essentially that they still have all of their rights, because normally that would be outside of their jurisdiction. Right. A police officer from, you know, New Jersey can't go to California and just start arresting people unless this agreement has been done in. Last week or the week before, a state of emergency was declared in North Dakota, allowing officers now to pour in. Hundreds of officers to pour in from other regions. Now, why is this interesting? First of all, it's interesting because this reminds us very much of, again, coming back to the G20, almost all of the charges or charges that were attempted to be laid or charges that were successfully laid against police officers were all against officers that were from out of town. This is an issue because, of course, if this is your community and you see these people every day, you're a lot less likely to do things you know are not right. If you go somewhere, it's like the whole thing where downtown Toronto, sometimes I live near a club. We have a problem where people who live out in the outskirts of Toronto will come down and they'll, trash and they'll drunk drive and all this sort of stuff and whatever. And it's not, because of where it's not because there's a problem with people who live in that spot. It's because people have a tendency to be less concerned about they're following the rules when they're in an area where they don't feel like, well, I'm just visiting here for 5 minutes. Who cares what I do? Mm. And this applies to police officers as well. Now, what becomes really interesting is when you come back and take a look at that fact that it's, you know, this is almost exclusively meant to be used for natural disasters. There is language there about insurgency and enemy attack and community disorders. The only other time this was pulled out during a non-disaster situation to use that community disorder part of the language was during the massive protests after the police killing of Freddie Gray in the U.S. As well. And so what's really interesting about this is just that, like, this is the level that the response, this is to protect a pipeline company's interests, lest their pipeline be delayed a short while a discussion is had, that no, instead, we should treat this like a freaking hurricane. That's the level of emergency that that preventing a private corporation from developing its project, they would rather call it an emergency and literally call in police from out of state then simply have a discussion. Now, I think I know why. I think that's because they're like, well, they're going to say no, they don't want this. And yeah, but maybe you should have a conversation about why they don't want that. There is another avenue, but instead just go straight to this thing about, nope, we're going to come in, we're going to show up hundreds of police officers, we're going to pull them from other precincts, we're going to turn our back while private security unleashes dogs on people, we're going to pepper straight them, we're going to block out cell phone towers, allegedly, we're going to shoot down drones so that we can't be surveilled, a media blackout, we're going to arrest journalists instead of letting a private corporation just go ahead and bully people and almost certainly pour toxic waste into a First Nation water supply.
Yeah.
But that makes sense, right, yeah, Stephen?
Exactly. And so I think the good place to end this is so what are they saying? What are the people in Standing Rock from the Standing Rock tribe what are they saying? And so I want to switch as the final part of the show, or final part of this section of the show,
segment, yeah.
I'm not going to end us 20 minutes early or anything, is a quote from a statement from Dave Archambault, who's a Standing Rock tribal chairman, who says basically that their call for is that militarized law enforcement agencies moved in on water protectors with tanks and riot gear today, the statement says. We will continue to pray for peace and will call on the state of North Dakota to oversee the actions of local law enforcement to first and foremost ensure everyone's safety. Really sounds like a statement coming from someone who's inciting a riot, right? Basically being like, send people, let people, like, their request is quite literally for people to come and actually see what is happening because of the fact that they know that that's what matters.
Well, and what's really hilarious is the Morton County Sheriff's Department actually sent out tweeted out an infographic showing that 90% of the protesters arrested for their unlawful actions while protesting the construction of DAPL were from out of state. And it shows this map covering lines going up to Canada, basically almost every state in the U.S. Basically, I think their thing was that, like, look, it's not even local people that are protesting. It's just all these foreigners, these state kind of foreigners, not realizing that they just did an amazing advertising job for rallying up support. Be like, look how widespread the resistance is, A, and B, you know, there's the effect of course, hey, well, if somebody from two states over can go, I can go. Well, so I think this was the most huge miscalculation tweet ever.
Let's also
short of Donald Trump. Like, he doesn't
count. Exactly. But let us also not remember the fact that what this has become is a focal point for First Nations groups all across America. And the idea to use, like, it's perhaps the most colonial ruthless thing to do, to use the out-of-state argument on a subset of people who existed before you made up the lines. Yeah. Like, you put a bunch of lines in, and then we're like, these people are from outside of these made-up lines I made, and they have been on this land for so much longer than your lines did. I can't put a line in between you and I, and I don't call you outside of, like, you're on the right side of this radio studio, Darren. So therefore, I don't, you know, you're a foreigner. Yeah. We've both been here for longer than that. This is it's a ludicrous piece. I just want to get one last paragraph from what they are asking for, so we can get that out, and then we can go to music break. So the statement continues. This is again the statement from Standing Rock Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault. which says the Department of Justice must send overseers immediately to ensure the protection of First Amendment rights and the safety of thousands here at Standing Rock. The DOJ can no longer ignore our requests. If harm comes to anyone, any who come here to stand in solidarity with us, it is on their watch. They must step in and hold the state of North Dakota and Morton County accountable for their acts of violence against innocent, prayerful people. So I feel, you know, if you're the Department of Justice, send in the overseers, because if these people are really the threat, the threat so much that you have to call in emergency security from, or emergency police officers from across the country, let's bring in people and let them see it.
It's really easy. Stopping a corporation from doing what it wants despite opposition is more of a state of emergency than climate change. Just say, if that's what you believe, then just say it,
right.
Clinton. But anyway, let's stop there. We're going to move on to local matters in a minute. I've got a little bit of my this week's Feisty Wheaties for Justin Trudeau coming up after the music break. It will be short because we went a little over time, but I think the DAPL thing was worth the time spent on it. So, Neil, please give us our next music break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, next we have another listener pick. It's the band is Pretty Lights, and the song is Shortcut Detour. And I just have to say that both songs requested today were awesome, and encourage listeners to request further songs that they...
Yeah, people sent that in because I played Deadmau5, so... Thank you very much to our listeners for sending in the great music. You know, I do like me some Deadmau5, but I would rather make you guys happy. I can listen to my music anytime. So please, by all means, send in some music for us. Great music picks today, and accidentally appropriate for this week's show, because
yeah.
They were sent in last week. We
That's
just didn't
true,
get
yeah.
to them. So there we go. So every time we get a little lull in music suggestions, I'll just play some more dance music.
Yeah, exactly. We'll threaten more Deadmau5, and people will start the requests will start flooding in.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got very little time. I want to get to this very important. So I said I had some Feisty Wheaties for Justin Trudeau, and what I want to start with, we just talked about the DAPL protest, and I want to move to, of course, the fact that we had a couple of young people on last week talking about
two weeks ago,
talking about Climate 101, which is an action that was to meet Justin Trudeau or outside Parliament in Ottawa last week is when the event happened. 100 people or 99 people were arrested at that by crossing onto the lawn. Very minor piece of civil disobedience. Nothing really happened as far as like, you know, the law being broken. They just stepped on a lawn they weren't supposed to step on, and 100 people got arrested. So, but what's very important here is that it was an article that I think somebody actually sent me here, but it's by Drew Ojaljay. And it's called "Youth Toss a Wrench in the Liberal Likeability Machine," and this is my recommended read for the week.
I really enjoy the term "the liberal likeability machine." Solid term.
Yes. Now, what's very interesting here, of course, is that this was after the arrests, and the Prime Minister was at a youth conference. And was there, and a number of people stood up and turned their backs on Justin Trudeau. He did not react well, and he basically urged them, said basically sit down. I'm going to find, while I'm scanning through here, while I'm talking, I'm just going to find the quote. But was basically wanted a photo op. And one of the point here of the argument was that a very interesting point, which I had it at a subconscious level, but I hadn't really focused the thought until this article kind of pointed out, which is why I suggest you read it, was the idea that essentially, like, the liberals are using all this engagement, like they're offering all this engagement. They're doing, especially with the missing and murdered Indigenous women and the investigation into issues around First Nations in this country. Very cool. Very important that's being done. Massive criticism that it's being useless or not being done as window dressing. And I think this is really the liberals' problem. And the argument the article makes, which I agree with wholeheartedly at this point, I could not possibly agree more, is that essentially the liberals are using this to to pull a bait and switch around actually doing stuff. So they're they're showing, and then the article points out correctly, I think, that the Trudeau basically admitted this. What they're saying was that now they're thinking about their, well, they don't really need to do electoral reform because the government's so popular. So what happens, what he's basically telling everybody is that if you participate with us and make us have the ability to tell the media to go tell the rest of Canadians that we are asking and engaging, that we then can do whatever we want, because the only thing anyone's going to pay attention to, if you're cynical or if you want to be optimistic and assume that they're naive and stupid, that is all Canadians want, is to, hey, well, as long as we hear them out, it doesn't matter what we do, as long as we hear them out. And so what the protests are centered around, I think, and this article very much centers around, is the idea that right now the only way to actually get something out of the Trudeau government is to not go in, not to do the photo ops. I love all these things of people going in and refusing to be in like photographs with him, not because I have some pet problem or because other people have some pet problem with not liking Trudeau on a personal level, but because he has demonstrated basically time and time again over the last year that every time you do that, he uses that to claim victory and then move on and not do anything about it. And so it was very, very ironic here that he was basically saying,
So
quote, this is Trudeau. "I look forward to hearing your questions. I look forward to sharing my perspectives on that. And I will tell you that it is a little bit frustrating for me to come in, sit down, look forward to hearing from you, talking with you, and seeing a room full of people who are standing in a way that shows they are not listening to me, and that you don't want to engage. And I think that reflects poorly on everyone who doesn't want to listen and engage." Okay.
Yeah.
Am I crazy, or did everybody catch that? If you don't listen to me, then you're not engaging.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
So, I mean, literally, he basically is telling you what he wants you to do. He wants you to come in, listen to him. He's going to call that engagement. He gets to declare mission accomplished, and then move on and do whatever he wants. And he's doing that on voter reform. He's doing that on First Nations issues, and he's doing that on climate change. And this really is just a rebranding of Harper. He's doing all the same things. He's doing a bunch of stuff that he can go and promote and say, look how liberal we are. We're talking to everybody to provide him cover to amount to the exact same policies. And it's for the exact same reason. Stefan, I don't want to jump in. Let me just finish this one thing, which is that what he's doing is that he contrives. That's why I was thinking about that thing I was saying before about maximizing fragility, because Trudeau, just like Clinton, just like Harper, he simply has a better marketing idea around how to do it. Is at the end of the day, the best thing for society is to maximize efficiency at the cost of every other interest, and that really will be what's best for everybody. Mm. And that's, I think, the most generous and fair way to interpret his comments, is that he thinks that we don't understand, and he really does think that this is the way to get what's best for everyone, and that he's going to basically ram it down our throats because he's Uncle Trudeau and he knows what's best. And at the end of the day, we'll all be so fabulous that we'll all be so amazed by how great it is that he'll end up being the champion. And he's wrong, because maximizing fragility is not what's best in Canada's interest. Now, I have 14 articles here. I'm not going to go through them. I'm just going to read a couple of titles really fast before I throw back to Stefan, which is just, again, this is just a handful of articles from this week. Communities challenging oil trains in their neighborhoods due to the volatility. Agency predicts bullish future ahead of renewable is powering past coal. The fact that two members of a regulator are saying that major pipeline companies aren't safe and want it shut down, and the only reason it hasn't been, despite the fact that it's poking out of the ground and all sorts of other things, because basically they just can't afford to turn it off. We'll protect the company at all costs. We have Premier Brad Wall, who's basically saying that carbon capture and storage is the way to go. Congratulations, throwing back to Harper. Well, guess what? Solar has gone from, like, since we started doing this show, from about 8% of the efficiency of oil and gas, it's now getting up into the 80s and 90s. And that's including the subsidies and all the benefits the industry get. If you wipe out those subsidies, solar and renewable on average as a portfolio is already better than these fossil fuels in this country. We have major newspapers, as you said, Bloomberg before, talking about the carbon bubble, why investors all across the market can no longer afford these carbon risks. Not to mention the fact that we now have climate change is on course to turn all of southern Spain into a desert by 2100. The fact that there's mounting legal challenges against basically every single pipeline in Canada, but specifically mounting on the LNG right now in BC. We have reports coming out, absent radical system change, the world faces the loss of 2/3 of all wildlife by 2100, 2200? No, 2020. 2/3 of all wildlife gone. And a very fascinating article, which sounds like link bait, but it's actually not. It is actually literally true. I encourage you to read this article. The sky is literally falling because of climate change, says top NASA scientist. And the argument around that is shockingly not metaphorical. Stefan, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, mostly just because I wanted to cover I want to speak directly to this idea of what Trudeau can do. Yeah, I can fully understand that if you see yourself as, you know, trying, doing everything that you can, quote unquote, and have to make, you know, like, oh, I'm doing all these things. And I still think you have to give him some, like, he hasn't even released his second budget yet. And so, you know, like, to some extent, you have to give some time for these things to start moving. But at the same time, like, if you want people to engage with you, and the same conversation we've had multiple times with the National Energy Board, the NEB, which is that if consultation is your only goal and it won't actually change how you act, then no one's going to want to talk to you. Like, that's just it. You know, I honestly think that the moment that you see the Trudeau government actually take a dangerous stand. You know, take a stand that they will be take a progressive stand that will be attacked in a real way.
Otherwise known as being a leader, by the way, true.
Yeah, you know, like actually take a stand on getting on fixing our electoral system. Actually block a pipeline. Do something to show that you're different. And, you know, people will point to like but he got 1 degree. He's got a price on carbon for nationally. And yes, that's great news. But that's not the kind of action that is policy always feels like weaker action because it can be undone by the next person. Right. In 4 years, you know, the next person can come in and undo something. But what really the fundamental pieces that you're really talking about are these other decisions that require sticking your neck out. And if you do, people will respect that. People will people aren't out. Like, some people are, definitely. Some people will never be happy with you, Trudeau. And you know that. Like, there's a certain percentage who will never
be
happy
with you. I would be happy if he's not being a coward.
Right. Yeah. So I think the thing here is to focus on is that, you know, if he took a stand and stopped Northern Gateway or Kinder Morgan, which was what the Climate 101 protest was about, you would see, you know, you would then have a leg to stand on when you demand dialogue. Like, if you're having this dialogue and you're getting overwhelming evidence that Canadians do not want this, or that Indigenous people are still feeling that you are not adequately collaborating with them, do something about it. Yeah. Take an action. Show that you're serious, and that will actually encourage people back to the table. But the way to get people back to the table is to prove that you're listening. Right. And these are the things you can do.
Sorry, speaking of which, we only have a minute left. I really wanted to get to this. So first of all, my gauntlet that's going down.
Yes, do it.
I can make an economic-only argument for not building any more pipelines and for making massive investments, an entire economy shift into renewable energy, not dealing with climate change at all, not dealing with land rights at all, not dealing with that. All those things are super important. But this is my challenge. If you have another show that you listen to or somebody that disagrees or you have access to a major news network, you want to go ahead and start emailing any news agency, any other show, any forum where more than a few people are going to listen to it, and somebody wants to debate me on whether or not there is a financial-only argument, an economic-only argument for taking the type of action that we propose on this show, I'm throwing down the gauntlet. I will accept, if it is financially possible for me, I will accept that challenge anywhere, anytime, to make that argument. Quickly, as well as talking about consultation, we did receive a note to the show that there's an Environment Committee seeking input from stakeholders on the review of the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. Information about how to submit your questions, queries, suggestions to that as well will be on the show. Also, in the bonus show, we're talking about how to build, not how to, but how somebody built a solar power home power system made for about 50 euros, which is about 75 bucks, made from entirely beer cans, and as well a much more serious story, which relates something earlier Stefan was saying about why we don't have and why we should have a national food policy. Thank you so much for listening to The Green Majority this week. We're going to be back in the bonus show in a couple minutes, and we'll miss you very greatly until next week. Thank you so much.